Hello, Register readers, and welcome to episode 15 of Semi-Coherent Computing. This is Ashley Vance, and once again, we've got a bit of a different show for you. We've got Steve Usden, who is an editor at BioCentury, but he's also the author of Engineering Communism, which is a pretty fantastic tale in part about the Soviet Union's version of Silicon Valley, but also about two American scientists who were spies and went on to kind of help found this Russian Silicon Valley called Zelenograd. And Steve's book goes over the story just in great detail, and we're going to get some of these details from Steve. How you doing, Steve?
Great. Thanks, Ashley. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's our pleasure. Thanks for giving us some time. So you wrote this book a little while ago, but I kind of ran across it. You gave a talk at the Computer History Museum that was, if I'm not wrong, last year or the year before.
It was the year before. It was around the time that the book came out. The book was published October 2005.
Okay. So I kind of came across it as one of those where I was like, this is a fascinating story, and I bought the book, but it took me a little while to, you know, it's in that stack of books that you have to read. And then I got there, and then I thought, got to get this guy on the show. I'm going to work backwards a little bit with you, if that's okay. I just wanted to give people first, if they haven't heard of Zelenograd, just an idea of what this place is, just a couple of the basics before we tell the story of how it came to be.
Sure. Zelenograd is a city. It was built starting in 1962, 1963. And it's actually a suburb of Moscow. And it was intended to be, when it was designed, it was intended to be one of several satellite cities. And they had the idea, some Soviet planners did, to move industry out of Moscow and relieve the congestion in Moscow and to build a series of satellite cities around Moscow. Only one of them ended up getting built, and that was Zelenograd. Initially, the idea was for it to have different kinds of industry there, but it got repurposed, I guess would be the way to say it, when the Soviet Ministry of Electronics got a hold of it. And it was dedicated entirely to microelectronics and computing. The idea of the city was that it would be everything that Silicon Valley is in the United States, that raw materials would come in on trucks, chips and computers, military electronics would go out. And that it would integrate both R&D and manufacturing, and also be the place where the workers and the scientists would live and have institutions of higher education oriented toward high technology. And that's, in fact, what happened. Today, there are, I think, about 300,000 people living there. It's still the hub of the Russian high-tech and computer industries.
Right. And it's funny. I mean, if you look on the Internet, I mean, there's a lot of information about it, but, you know, I certainly had never heard of it before I saw your talk, and, you know, I get the feeling that not too many people in the U.S. are kind of aware of this place. Is that kind of the right?
Well, yeah, and that was actually, during the Soviet times, that wasn't an accident. It didn't appear on maps. It was, for a long time. The Soviets never talked about what it was for until very late, toward the end of the Soviet regime. It was a closed city. It was a place that foreigners couldn't go without special permission, and that special permission wasn't often granted. And actually, Russians weren't encouraged to ask a lot of questions about it either.
You know, I have to confess it was a couple months ago since I've read the book. But if I remember correctly, you were living in Russia at the time that you first kind of became aware of Zelenograd.
Yeah, I was living in, and that kind of gets into how I ended up writing the book. I was living and reporting in Russia. I was living in Moscow, and this was fall of 1990. And I was reporting about technology transfer between the Soviet Union and the United States. And I met a banker who was negotiating technology transfer deals. And I asked him who was the most interesting Soviet scientist that he knew. And he told me, well, there's this fellow named Joseph Berg who has invented a new technology for manufacturing silicon chips, and that I should meet him. So I went to meet him at this banker's office the next day. We got to know each other quite very kind of one of these things where you just become friends just right on first meeting, and we just were talking about a lot of things, and he invited me to lunch, and then he said, well, do you want to go out and see one of the most interesting places in the Soviet Union that almost no foreigners have ever seen? And of course I said yes, and he was going out there, and he a limo came and picked us up from the hotel where we were having lunch, and drove us about 45 minutes out of downtown Moscow to Zelenograd.
That's kind of what you dream about when you're a reporter, right? Some guy says, do you want me to take you to this special place? That
Yeah. It was quite kind of a magical moment. And this fellow, Joel Barr, who in Russia was known as Joseph Berg, was like that. He was the kind of guy who always made very, very interesting things happen to the people who were around him and had a very interesting life himself.
So obviously, Joseph Berg doesn't strike you as a Russian name.
No, the way that he got his name was interesting. I guess maybe we should back up a little, kind of tell the story of who he was and how he came to get the name. So he was born Joel Barr, January 1st of 1916 in the United States in New York. He grew up in New York. He became a communist, actually while he was in high school, during the Depression. And then he went to City College of New York. And at City College of New York, he fell in with a group of communists there. And this informal group was headed by another engineer whose name was Julius Rosenberg. After they graduated from City College of New York, both Joel Barr and Julius Rosenberg and all of their friends got jobs as electrical engineers. And almost all of them got jobs working for the government, mostly for the military. They were all adamant communists. And this was at a time when the Soviet Union had signed a pact that the Soviet Union was allied with Nazi Germany. And the U.S. Communist Party was really just a subsidiary of the Soviet Communist Party. And it followed the line that came from Moscow completely. So the U.S. Communist Party's line was to oppose American involvement in the war in Europe and to oppose American efforts to help Great Britain defend itself from the Nazis, because the Soviets their official line was that the war was a war of the bourgeois industrialists and that the Americans should stay out of it. So Julius Rosenberg and Joel Barr and their friends were conflicted because their communist beliefs and their party was telling them that they shouldn't be helping the United States to militarize, but the only work that they could get was as engineers working in the military-industrial complex. So Julius Rosenberg came up with a way to kind of square the circle, and his idea was, well, why don't I provide the information that I'm getting at work to the Soviet Union, and that way I'll really be helping to build communism, which was his real goal. He made his way several senior members of the American Communist Party until he found one who actually had connections with Soviet intelligence, and he was recruited as an agent of the Soviet Union, of what we later came to call the KGB. And then he recruited Joel Barr, and they recruited a group of about 8 engineers in total who spied for the Soviet Union during and after the Second World War.
These guys, you make the point in your book, they weren't terribly clandestine about their activities at that point as far as going to rallies or, being members of this and that organization. I mean, they were pretty open about.
Now, the amazing thing actually is about the Rosenberg story and about Joel Barr's story and the group around them. It's really one of counterintelligence and competence on the part of the FBI and Army counterintelligence. For example, the FBI and the Army were aware of the fact that members of the Communist Party might be security threats. So they had a program in place to try to figure out who were secret members of the Communist Party and to prevent them from having access to classified information. Julius Rosenberg and Joel Barr and several other members of their network had actually been identified by the FBI and by Army intelligence as communists. And they had been fired from their jobs working for the Army Signal Corps and other parts of the U.S. military because they were communists. But the amazing thing is that each of them managed to get jobs working for private industry that had access, that gave them access to even more classified information within weeks of being fired by the Army. And there was never any system to vet them or to clear them. So they continued spying for, in some cases, years after the FBI and military intelligence had identified them as security threats.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So this is some of the stuff I wanted to dig into a little bit. So you've got this guy, Joel Barr and Julius Rosenberg, and they're friends with, I mean, pretty engineering minded kids, some bright guys. And like you said, I mean, list a couple of the places that Joel worked. He worked, you mentioned one, this at the Signal Corps.
He started out working at Fort Monmouth for the U.S. Army Signal Corps. And he was working on a project. He was working on early radar systems, early microwave radar. At that time, radar was considered so classified that even the word radar was classified. It wasn't the Army tried to keep it out of print and tried to keep any discussion of the notion of radar out of the public domain. And Joel Barr was working on the most advanced radar systems that were in the American arsenal. They were radar systems that were used for guiding bombs so that Americans could do night bombing and bombing during cloudy weather. And more importantly, there were radar systems, there were airborne radar systems that were used to detect German submarines. There were microwave radar systems that were used to detect German submarines. What was important about that in terms of security is that the thing that was of paramount importance for the American military and for the British military was for the Germans to not know what kind of radar the Americans were using, because then they could build detectors. They could build radar detectors, and that would have nullified their use. And in fact, early in the war, that happened. The British had a radar system that they were using to detect German submarines when they're on the surface. And the Germans figured this out, and they built radar detectors, and they could detect the fact that, you know, when British airplanes had locked onto them, and then they would dive, and they would become invisible. The point is that Joel Barr was working on some of the most advanced radar systems that were in the U.S. and British arsenal at the time. And then later he went to work on land-based radar systems, in particular one called the SCR-584, which was coupled with an analog computer that created the first automated anti-aircraft weapons in the world. It was very important weapons during the Second World War. The interesting thing is that Barr and Rosenberg and the other members of their ring were actually, they were middle-level engineers. They were basically in charge of quality control. The Army would send them to factories that were building these radars, and their job was to ensure quality and also to try to optimize the manufacturing methods. So they were encouraged. Their job was to understand everything that there was to know about how these radars were built, how they were supposed to function, and even to understand how every other radar system was built so that they could apply that information to the systems that they were building, that they were in charge of. And if you think about it, that put them in the optimal position to be giving information to the Soviets, because they could give the Soviets actual blueprints of the radars and detailed manufacturing instructions, kind of a cookbook for how you manufacture these things. It was a perfect position if you wanted to figure out where you wanted to have a spy in American industry. Besides radar, the Rosenberg group as a whole worked on a number of other really important technologies. One of the technologies that they worked on was something called the proximity fuse. And it was probably after the atom bomb, it might be the most important weapon of the Second World War. It was built to solve the problem that they had that was developed when airplanes got to be much faster. It got to be very difficult to shoot them down. Before, when airplanes were relatively slow, you could visually look and see where you thought they were going and aim the gun ahead of them and shoot and fire it off and boom, hit it. You know, basically they had some versions of that. But when airplanes got to be much faster, of course, that didn't work. What the proximity fuse was a little tiny radio transmitter and receiver that was on the end of a shell, and it would send out because there's essentially the same technologies in use today. It sends out a radio signal, and when that would hit something, in this case an airplane, it would bounce back, and through the interference pattern from different radio signals going and coming, it would figure out how far away it was from the target. And when it was at the predetermined distance, then it would blow up. That way you didn't have to actually hit the target. You had to, you know, it could just come close and would destroy it. Julius Rosenberg actually gave the Soviets, first he gave them the blueprints for the proximity fuse, and then he actually managed to steal a working model of it and gave that to the Soviet Union. Just one other thing, another technology that was very important that they gave was early jet engine technology. They gave the designs for the first American jet engines, and they also gave results from wind tunnel tests that had been done of American fuselages that were simulating the speeds that would be created by jet engines.
So all in all, some pretty handy stuff.
Very, very important technology, yeah. And it's interesting because in the case of the Rosenberg Ring, it's one of the few cases of Soviet industrial espionage where you can actually see first in detail what was taken and then what was done with it by the Soviet Union, because after the Second World War, the Soviets started mass producing airborne and land-based radars, for example, and they were copies of American radar, and it just happens that they were copies of the American radar systems that Joel Barr and the other members of the Rosenberg Ring were working on.
So, I mean, these guys are getting this amazing technology, and this is before the days of even when you had, I mean, let alone some kind of biometric scan or even just a little badge to get in the door. So basically, as you describe in your book, there were days when Joel went into the office and he put some things in his briefcase and they just thought he was going home to do a little extra work burning the midnight oil.
They were encouraged to bring their work home with them. It wasn't even that they had to sneak it out. You know, it was a war, and the idea was that the people were supposed to be working around the clock, so they were encouraged to bring their work home with them, and they had no difficulty doing that whatsoever. The Soviets gave them cameras and microfilm, and they set up a little, you know, document copying facility in their apartment, and copied literally thousands and thousands of pages of classified information.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about how the information actually got to the Soviets, because you've got these guys who are more or less, if someone is in Silicon Valley today, I mean, they were engineers, you know, and then but by night they're playing this kind of spy game. And I mean, this was serious stuff to some degree. In your book, you walk through some of the elaborate, you know, they would go out walking for 2, 3, 4 hours trying to make sure they weren't being tailed before they made a drop off. Could you tell us maybe, you know, just an anecdote to describe what they had to go through to kind of get their information either to Julius Rosenberg or another Soviet agent?
The exact techniques that they used changed a little bit during the war and after the war as American security got tighter. But basically, they would copy the documents. In the case of Joel Barr, he would copy the documents in an apartment that he shared with Alfred Sarant in Greenwich Village. Then they would take the films, and they would have to meet. Joel Barr would meet with his Soviet contact. Usually they would meet, or often they would meet, on a railroad platform, or they would meet in a what they called an automat, a diner where they would get their food out of a machine so that there'd be no waitresses there. Usually they would what they call dry clean for maybe 2 hours before they met, which would mean that they would walk around the city and they would take, you know, different routes that would allow them to be able to see whether somebody was tailing them. You know, they'd go places where they could, you know, see people in windows behind them and things like that, and switch from buses to subway, go into buildings where they would go in one exit and go out another exit, things like that. And then they would when they would meet with their Soviet contact, they would arrange that they would be walking towards each other on a street and looking over each other's shoulders, and each one would have to give a signal to the other one to indicate that they thought that all was clear and that they could meet. Usually they would exchange the information without actually talking. Often they would be carrying a newspaper, identical newspapers, and they would have, for example, Barr would have the film in a container inside his newspaper, and his Soviet officer might have some kind of instructions in his, and, you know, they would walk by each other and exchange newspapers in a way that, you know, unless people were being extremely vigilant, nobody would notice. Or they would be in a restaurant somewhere, and one would put they would be near each other, and each would put the newspapers down, and then take each other's newspapers and leave without anybody seeing them.
Right, and you mentioned Alfred Sarant in there, who's going to be, you know, the other main character in this story. So these guys were friends, and when they weren't doing work as engineers and spies, these guys lived pretty normal lives. They enjoyed music, they enjoyed the ladies, and I mean, it sounds like they had, all in all, they were pretty likable characters.
They were, and, you know, basically, espionage didn't really define their lives. I think that as far as they were concerned, this was part of what they were doing, but these were, you know, these were young guys, and they were had a lot of different things going on in their lives and a lot of things on their minds, and they did have pretty interesting lives. So Julius Rosenberg and Joel Barr had known each other at City College. A number of other members of the Rosenberg Ring met each other at City College, but Sarant was kind of the outlier in the group. For one thing, he was the only one who wasn't Jewish. All the rest of them were Jewish. Sarant was of Greek heritage. he met Barr at Fort Monmouth at the Signal Corps. There were engineers there together. Barr recruited him into espionage, and then they lived together in an apartment in Greenwich Village. They were both very much into music. Sarant was into the folk music scene. He knew a lot of the people who were around Pete Seeger and some of the other folk singers, and they would have parties at their apartment with folk singers. And at that time also they had black people, African Americans, who would come to their parties, which was kind of a scandalous thing in the 1940s in the United States.
And then, as you mentioned, I mean, these guys are going, you know, they're being identified as communists periodically, and the FBI now and again would keep an eye on them, but for a relatively short amount of time, and they would hop from one job working on classified information to another. But eventually things started to get a bit tighter once there were, if I remember correctly, I mean, there were a couple leaks where the U.S. started to get an idea of just how deep the espionage was going. And maybe could you walk us through a little bit about when they, both men, decide to start leaving the U.S.?
Okay, so they actually left the United States separately and under very different circumstances. In 1948, Joel Barr was working for a company called Ferry Gyroscope. And he was working on radar systems for what would become to be known as intercontinental ballistic missiles. And he was providing that information to the Soviet Union. After he'd been working there for some months, the Sperry security people contacted the FBI to ask for what we would call today clearance. You know, the FBI looked in their files, and lo and behold, they figured out that Barr had been fired as a communist security threat many years earlier from the Signal Corps. Then they looked further in their files, and they found that relatively recent Communist Party records that they'd gotten by illegally breaking into the Communist Party offices in Manhattan indicated that he was still a member of the Communist Party, and he'd lied on his job applications indicating that he wasn't a member of the Communist Party. So Sperry Rand, Sperry Gyroscope, when they found out about that, fired him. And Barr looked around, and he got pretty worried. First, I think he was worried that they might be on to his espionage, and second, he realized that there really wasn't much of a future for him in electronics in the United States. Nobody was going to hire somebody who didn't have a security clearance to do the kind of electrical engineering that he was interested in doing. And in any case, he had another interest in life, which was music. He was a very talented musician and had been studying composition. So he decided to leave the United States and to go to Europe. And the Soviet Union had a kind of version of the GI Bill for spies, where they regularly gave stipends to people who had been spying for them to pursue their education, partly with the idea that then they would become more useful in the future. So Barr left the United States and went to Scandinavia for some time, and then ended up in Paris studying music with an interesting avant-garde composer named Messiaen. Meanwhile, in the United States, Sarant went to Ithaca, New York, and got working on the cyclotron, and became very close friends with some of the more famous physicists who were also at Ithaca, Feynman and Hans Bethe and some other physicists there. Then the Rosenberg ring started to crumble. The army had managed to decrypt some of the Soviet communications, some of the Soviet cables that had been sent during the Second World War. And they collaborated with the FBI to try to track down who the people were who were identified in the cables by cover names. Actually, the first person that came under suspicion was Joel Barr, but he was overseas, and the FBI didn't really pursue it. Eventually, the trail led to Julius Rosenberg's brother-in-law, David Greenglass, and he was arrested. He immediately confessed and implicated Julius Rosenberg. And then Julius Rosenberg was arrested, and the trail very quickly led to Alfred Sarant. The FBI went to Ithaca and interrogated Sarant. They didn't arrest him right away. They had the idea that he might cooperate and that he might tell more if they interviewed him without arresting him. I think they had the idea that they would get him to testify against Julius Rosenberg or some of the other members of the ring. He realized that he was going to be arrested, and he hatched a scheme to escape, and he actually managed to do it. He left with his next-door neighbor's wife. He left behind his wife and two children, and she left behind her husband and two children, And they got in a car and basically fooled the FBI and managed to get across the border to Mexico. And they were in Mexico for a couple of weeks before the FBI really figured out where they were. And then Sorrent and the woman who he'd left with, Carol Dayton, went. They traveled around to Mexico for a few months and basically ended up in Mexico City broke and out of money and at a loss for what to do. They considered going to the Soviet embassy there, but when they went with the intention of going to the Soviet embassy, they were spooked because they saw some cars circling around the embassy and they thought that that was FBI surveillance. They went back to their hotel room, and then Sorrent came up with the idea. He went through the yellow pages and he found a Polish trade mission, and he figured that that was probably a front for Polish intelligence, and he was right. He went to the Polish trade mission, and he told them that he was on the run from the FBI, that he wanted to help build communism, and could they help him? They cabled to Russia, and they cabled to Warsaw, and Warsaw cabled to Moscow, and the word came back that they should help Sorrent and Carol Dayton escape. So the Poles kept them underground in Mexico for a few months, and disguised them, and then slipped them across the border. They actually waded across a river to Guatemala, and then they boarded a Polish cargo ship in Guatemala, which took them to Casablanca. And then they flew from Casablanca to they took a ship from Casablanca to Spain. And then they flew from Spain to Warsaw and spent 6 months in Warsaw. Meanwhile, the day after David Greenglass was arrested, Joel Barr disappeared from Paris. He went to Switzerland, and then from Switzerland went to Prague. And when he got to Prague, he was met by the KGB, and they set him up with a new identity and a new new name. And that's how he came to be known as Joseph Berg. His identity was that he was supposed to have been born and raised in Johannesburg. So his name was a kind of a KGB joke. He was Joe Berg from Joburg. Meanwhile, Sorrent, Berg, as he was for the rest of his life, Berg learned Czech quite quickly. He was very talented in languages and got a job working as an engineer for an electronics company or electronics enterprise. One day when he was, after he'd been working there for some time, he got a visit from one of his intelligence contacts who told him that he was supposed to go to Moscow and that he should go home and go out and get a ticket for Moscow and that and to give this guy his passport, and this guy would arrange, would stamp the visa in it. And when he asked what he was going for, what the purpose of the trip was, he was just told that, you know, it was an important mission and that he'd find out when he got out there what it was all about. So he got on the plane and he went to Moscow, and he was met by a driver at the airport in Moscow, who drove him downtown to a hotel and that was within sight of the Kremlin, and he handed over his passport and got his keys, and he went up to his room. He opened the door, and when he opened the door, Sorrent and Carol Dayton were standing there in the room. The Russians had brought him there, and they created this very dramatic reunion for the two of them.
Yeah, there's kind of this. I mean, there's kind of a nice moment in the book where they kind of meet up again and exchange their tales about how they had gotten there.
Yeah, so you know, Barr, he had no idea. He'd been reading in the newspapers. He knew that, of course, he knew that David Greenglass had been arrested. He knew that Rosenberg had been arrested. He knew that another member of the ring, who was also a close friend of his, Morton Sobel, had been arrested. You know, he had no idea what had happened to Sorrent, who was really his closest friend in the world. So it was this kind of extraordinary emotional scene where, you know, he opened the door, and then to his, you know, amazement, this person who he'd been so worried about what happened to him was standing there and, you know, obviously safe and sound. The two of them spent 6 weeks in Moscow. Then the Soviets decided to send them back to Prague. When they went back to Prague, they were put in, for one thing, Sorrent kind of asserted himself as the leader of the two of them at that time when they were in Moscow. And from that point on, for the rest of their lives, Sorrent was really the one who was the kind of the dominant one of the two of them.
Explain that a little more, just because by most accounts, I mean, Berg was seen as the smarter of the two, and that was I don't know if that was a sticking point for Surratt in their particular relationship, but Surratt always wanted people to see him as being very intelligent.
Well, he was. I never met him. He died before. Well before I met Barr. But by all accounts, he was a kind of genius. But when he'd been in the United States, he'd been a frustrated genius. His talents hadn't been appreciated, and he never really got very far in the United States. And people that knew them both in the United States really thought of Barr as being the more intellectual and being the more accomplished of the two. But when they got to the Soviet Union, Surratt basically said, you know what, shortly after they had this kind of dramatic reunion, he said, you know, from now on, I'm going to be the boss. And he was, and Surratt was much more assertive and much more sly about the way that he dealt with the Soviet authorities. He convinced the Soviets that he and Barr had, that they had been brilliant engineers in the United States, but that they had been oppressed and never rose to a very high level because of prejudice against communists and against leftists in the United States. And he asked the Soviets to give him an opportunity to prove himself. So they did. They gave him an opportunity. They sent Barr and Surratt to Prague, and they put them in charge of a team of engineers, about 40 people, and their task was to build a prototype that could be reproduced of an automated anti-aircraft weapon, similar to the ones that they had worked on in the United States. And they succeeded. They built the first automated anti-aircraft weapon in the Soviet bloc, and it was reproduced, it was put into production, and it was actually used in Czechoslovakia with some minor modifications, at least through the 1980s, and it became the basis for anti-aircraft weapons that were more broadly deployed by the Soviets, both in Russia and the Soviet Union and in Vietnam.
And just before we jump on to the next bit, I mean, when you were talking about the story with Surratt leaving the U.S. and he leaves with his next-door neighbor's wife, and I mean, essentially, they just go on very quickly. They go on the lam, more or less, and I mean, did you ever get a sense that, I was wondering that when I was reading the book, just, you talk about her later in the book and in some detail, but just the kind of leap of sort of faith that she takes right there. I mean, did you ever get a feel for just her emotional state at that point?
She was really distraught, and it was a very difficult thing for her. She'd been having an affair with Surratt, for several months before all of this came up. And Surratt was still living with his wife and kids, but he had been estranged from his wife. But she still loved her husband, and she certainly was extremely attached to her kids. And when she left with Surratt, she didn't have any intention of leaving forever. She thought that she was going to help him get out of a jam, that she'd help him get to Mexico, and that she'd come back. But when they got to Mexico City, Polish intelligence told her that if she went back to the United States, that she would be thrown in jail, and that her children, you know, it wouldn't be any good to her children or her husband anyway, because she was going to spend the rest of her life in jail. So she felt that she really had no choice but to leave with Surratt. But she never forgot her kids, and the ones who she left behind. And I don't want to jump forward in the story. Maybe we'll get to it, but. She always kept that kind of emotional connection, both with her kids and with the husband that she'd left behind.
Yeah, I just bring it up because there's some of these nice emotional stories, you know, that underlie this more kind of fantastic.
I think actually her story might be the most amazing story in the whole saga, because here she is. She left. She got up and left home one day, basically expecting to be away for, you know, a few days or weeks, and she ended up going to Czechoslovakia and then to the Soviet Union and living there for decades. She had four children with Surratt, who, by the way, he adopted the name of Philip Staros in Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union. And then when he died, her children that she'd had with Saranta in the Soviet Union, they were very anxious for her to regain contact with the family that she'd left behind. Over the years, she'd told them little bits and pieces about what her prior life had been like. Eventually, after the Soviet Union collapsed, she managed to come back to the United States, and one of her daughters had preceded her. She came back to the United States, and maybe the most remarkable thing is that then she eventually got back together again with the man who she'd left 4 decades earlier, and reconciled with him, and is living with him to this day. They're both still alive, and they're living together quite happily.
It's just, there's so many amazing stories in this book, and somebody could write a thrilling movie or a book just about that one, more or less. So the Soviets, they're already impressed with the work these guys had done as spies, and now, not only while being spies, they proved themselves as engineers just by the work that they were doing, but now they do something very practical with their knowledge for the Soviets in what was then Czechoslovakia. And so then they make their way back to Russia.
They make their way back to the Soviet Union. They're invited to come to what's then Leningrad, today St. Petersburg, to head up a laboratory there. And they go to Leningrad in 1956. The date's important because Stalin was already dead, and the kind of the terror that of the last few years of his life was over. I think that if they hadn't gone to Czechoslovakia when they met up in Moscow, if they'd stayed in Russia, there's almost no doubt they would have ended up their lives in a gulag. In any case, they went to Leningrad and they were put in charge of a team there. And first they worked on a project building potentiometers for the Sputnik, for the first satellite, actually for the devices that were used for tracking it. But then they got to work on what they really wanted to, which was on computing. And they built some of the first, the first small desktop control computers that were built in the Soviet Union. And they attracted a great deal of attention at the highest levels for the work that they were doing.
Yeah, they were kind of like the Alto, if people are familiar with that. At least that was the comparison I was making in my mind. It was like the Soviet version of the Alto from Xerox PARC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were at the forefront of thinking about electronics and about microelectronics. In fact, Staros introduced the word microelectronics into the Russian language, and he was kind of an evangelist for the concepts of microelectronics and microengineering. He would go around and give lectures about it to senior officials in the Soviet government and so on. So they built the first prototype of a small desktop computer in the Soviet Union. Prior to that, all the Soviet computers had been these huge behemoths, things with vacuum tubes that filled up whole rooms and things like that. And Staros said, no, that's not the direction to go. These huge, specialized, unwieldy computers. The direction to go is to build small desktop computers that can be mass-produced and used for a lot of different purposes. And he built one. It attracted a lot of attention. In particular, it attracted the attention of a man named Dmitry Ustinov. Ustinov was impressed and gave him more resources and gave them more people. And they built another computer called the UM-1. While they were working on that and other military, and that had military applications, it was intended as an airborne computer to use for control purposes in military aircraft. While they were working on that, they met a young engineer who was working on the Soviet cruise missile project, who came to visit them to ask for their help on something that he was working on. He was very impressed with them. And he went home and told his father that he'd met these very interesting engineers who were really doing extremely exciting stuff that could be important for the future of the Soviet Union. The young engineer's name was Sergei Khrushchev, and his father was Nikita Khrushchev. So Nikita Khrushchev asked around about him, about these guys, and it's not clear, actually, whether he personally made the decision initially to allow them to come to the Soviet Union or whether he was aware of it. It's likely that he was, but I don't know that for sure. In any case, he was impressed by what he heard, and he arranged to come and to visit their laboratory and to tour it. And that was a remarkable way for him to single them out and to give them tremendous stature in the Soviet system for Nikita Khrushchev to come to somebody's laboratory like that. It was an incredible thing.
Yeah, let me.
So he came. And,
sorry, can I, just before we get to their big pitch that's coming next, even though they were spies, surely the Soviets had doubts about these two Americans. I mean, how did they know that this wasn't some elaborate plan by the U.S. to do their own espionage?
You know, I think that there were people in the Soviet Union who distrusted them and who hated them for the whole time they were there and who accused them of being American spies. But the Soviet intelligence officers who had handled them and who had handled the Rosenbergs had tremendous respect for them. And they also, I think, the fact that they were associated with the Rosenbergs also was tremendously important for the Soviet for the KGB officers who handled them, because they had a tremendous. It's hard for people here to understand or to believe it, but I've met some of the KGB officers who were involved with the Rosenbergs and with other intelligence operations around the same time, and they were tremendously sentimental about the Rosenbergs and about Barr and about Sarant. There was just a feeling of horror and revulsion, actually, that they'd been involved with this case that had led to the Rosenbergs, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, being executed. And I think that gave the Soviets a real sense of trust.
So they had
and they were spied on also. I mean, they were under observation, and the Soviet Union was a very tight place in those days, and it would have been very difficult for Sarant or Barr to have communicated any information to the CIA or anywhere else.
But to some degree, they had sacrificed so much, and so had their peers, and they'd also done such a good job spying for the Soviets that, I mean, there was a level of trust that brought Khrushchev, you know, brought a meeting with Khrushchev.
Yeah, so Khrushchev came to their design bureau, as it was called, and they gave him a tour, and they did a basically, they'd been preparing for this for some time in advance, and they actually rehearsed it and did a dress run through, you know, the day before. And they did what Barr described to me as an American-style PR campaign. And they showed him technicians creating small electronic devices. They showed him their prototype computer. And they told him that the future of Soviet power is not going to be determined by the size of the hydroelectric dams that the Soviet Union can build, or the number of tons of steel they can produce, or the number of soldiers in the army. That actually the future of Soviet power is going to be determined by these really tiny little electronic devices, by microelectronics. And Khrushchev loved the idea. He'd actually, before that meeting, he'd been in the United States, and he'd been taken on a tour at IBM, and he'd been introduced to the idea of what computers are and what electronics are and so on. And he very much liked the idea that technology could advance Soviet power, because that meant that it wasn't necessary to have huge standing armies, for example. So Sarant told him, he said, you know, he showed him, they had drawings, you know, and they showed what today we would call Star Wars, you know, a missile defense system. And they said, you know, if you invest in microelectronics, you know, we're going to be able to do this, and we're going to be able to surpass the United States in power production and in all kinds of things. He painted this a utopian vision of future from the Soviet perspective. And at the end of the visit, he took him into a room, and he said, his proposal for how to do this was to create a city dedicated entirely to microelectronics and computing. And Khrushchev agreed right there on the spot. And that's how the decision really was made to build Zelenograd. And a month later, which was really lightning speed for the Soviet bureaucracy, the Politburo gave orders for the creation of Zelenograd.
For the listeners out there, we're going to call that the end of part one of this episode, talking with Steve Usden about engineering communism.